Okay, so this is going to be another situational assessment from Jordan Hall. He did this one on March 26th, and it was out of the STOA. So Jordan came in, did his situational assessment, and we opened it up to some Q&As. The next situational assessment with Jordan Hall is going to be occurring this Saturday. That is April 4th at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. In order to RSVP to that, go to www.thestoa.ca. The STOA is spelled the and S-T-O-A. And it's also going to be in the show notes, so you can go there. And yeah, just RSVP. We've been having 40 to 60 people on these calls. If it starts going above 100, then I'm going to have to upgrade my Zoom account. But so far, the questions have been really, really high quality, and these have been a treat so far to have Jordan come in and do these situational assessment. I think they've been really helpful and grounding for a lot of people. Welcome to the STOA. The STOA is a digital campfire where we cohere and dialogue about what matters most at the knife's edge of what's happening now. Today we have Jordan Hall, who's going to provide a situational assessment, and I'll hand it to Jordan in a moment. But how today's going to work, Jordan will provide a situational assessment. I'll ask him a few questions, and when I'm asking him questions, just write down your question in the chat box, and I will call on you. Just unmute yourself and ask your question to Jordan. If you prefer that I read your question on your behalf, just indicate that when you write it down. That being said, I'll hand it over to Jordan. What's the situation, my friend?
I mute myself.
Okay. I muted you.
Yeah. Oh, mercy. All right. So let me see. I guess the first thing that comes to mind is a very clear sense of the recognition of the fact that the primary situation is building chaos. That the ability to even try to grasp the whole of what's happening in any particular perspective and narrowly focus it into a set of linear words is sort of obviously not the right possibility. So I'll sort of try to just give some richness of the things that I'm seeing, recognizing that my perspective has some things going for it and a whole bunch of things that aren't, and just put it out there. But the hope is that this notion that there is a way of us being able to rediscover this campfire concept and to rapidly rebuild a capacity to do the thing that humans are natively endowed to do, which is to come together and form a higher kind of shared perspective, shared consciousness, is what I would say is the thing at the very front end. So there's lots and lots of things that are going on in kind of the day-to-day, and everybody's unique circumstances are the unique circumstances. But the one thing that I think is shared is this event is the prototype of what, in fact, everybody should be beginning to get better at doing. So TLDR, that's the beginning of the end. Also, a note from our sponsor. I need to make sure that Brett Weinstein is called out as the person who first and foremost urged me to be thinking about that kind of thing, the notion of the campfire as being both the beginning and the archetype of what it means for people to come together in a place of where consciousness arises. So hopefully we'll be seeing more of him on this front. So as I look around, I notice that in my own personal life, there's such a very wide variety of different places where my attention is pulled. I spent this morning talking to literally actual special operations people who are embedding themselves directly into the gaps in the medical system in New York City. So one element of the situation assessment, at least for people in North America, is that the capital of the American empire happens to be the hotspot. And it is within days of having what is known as medical system overwhelm and maybe even today, medical system overwhelm in a big way, meaning we'll begin to start having overflow, individuals who need ICU who can't get access to ICU. And that will continue to proceed in some sort of exponential path over the next few days and weeks. So the situation on the ground in New York is both the real thing that has real human beings undergoing real situations, but also serves as an enormous archetype I'll get back to that in a second, actually. Let me jump to Sweden. I was just getting off a call with Nora Bateson, who, by the way, her virtual version of the Warm Data Labs also serves as a deeply, deeply insightful prototype or model of this kind of thing done well. So, Peter, I'm going to connect you with her more or less. I was actually writing the email before I had to jump onto this. Those kinds of things need to be cross-fertilized. Yesterday, I was on a call with Benita Roy, and she has a group called the Rad Cat Club, who's doing their own variation on the theme. In my conversation with Nora, she was pointing out the way that Sweden is responding to what's happening, which is on its own knife's edge. And there's a shared sensibility that we're going through something that is in many ways best grasped, not at the physical level, but actually at the mythopoetic level, at the level of the way artists relate to reality. And that there's something that's going on. There's something where there's a, there's something so like almost, how would I say it? Well, I'll just say it, perfect about the nature of how this crisis is unfolding that is shaking out the particularities of cultures and the way that the dark shadow aspects of the Swedish culture, for example, cannot help but become rise to the surface. Switching back to the US of A, it's sort of almost funny that the sort of the robber baron archetype that is so much woven into the fabric of the American story now cannot help but dress themselves up in a shiny gold outfit and sort of brazenly show the degree to which they are endeavoring to loot the treasury. They can't even be clever about it. They have to come up and stand on stage and say, yeah, we're going to blow through $4 trillion in the next 48 hours. And by the way, this problem is no problem. It's going to be 2 weeks. We'll be right back to business. You have to expect an enormously significant amount of stupidity on the part of the people you're talking to. And it tells me that there's more going on. Like there's something happening where vice somehow is being forced to magnify itself to its maximum proportion so that we collectively cannot but address it directly. And there's something about that that I think is at the center of it, that I think my friend Zach Stein is actually in the process, maybe just published an article talking about it as the war in heaven, meaning that there's something going on that, again, mythopoetic. The world we've been living in, the system we've been living in, has been rotten for quite some time. And there's nothing really about it that's obligatory. Nora talked about it like, imagine a gingerbread man that's made out of something that's like, you guys remember that funny stuff you could make in physics class in like middle school that was like sand or cornstarch with water, or you pushed on it really hard, it was solid, but if you didn't, it flowed back into a goo. So imagine you poured something like that into a cookie cutter gingerbread man, and that's your identity. That's who we are. We sort of formed ourselves against the institutional structure and the expectations of the socio-technical environment into which we have been poured. But there is no reality beyond that. It's obviously ineffective and inadequate. And as that structure is actually now forcibly being removed, the goo that we are is beginning to ooze back out. And we're finding ourselves in the kind of the enemy and the angst of the liminality of, wow, hold on, that was actually never real. But now we're forced to realize it wasn't real. And it feels really weird and bad to actually take responsibility for who we are in the first place. Oh, and by the way, even our notionality of the idea of an individual was a projection invented sometime in our relatively recent past. We're having to go deep and refigure that entire concept. Layering onto that, just to throw that visual metaphor into some hectic notions, I said, okay, now take my image right now as I'm actually seeing all these sort of these wires and coils that are being shoved into that cookie cutter. These are things like our collective and individual traumas that have been forced to be held inside individuals and inside our bodies and our psyches that were never the right container in the first place. And now what happens is that when that cookie cutter shape gets popped off, not only does our identity and self begin to ooze out, but those wires pop out into the space in all kinds of ways. And it surfaces things that we were holding back and that should have been held in a much more common location. So campfires like this. And she's in fact discovering some amazing things that in her warm data environments, the campfires that she's organizing, people are having these bizarre experiences where traumas that they thought were their own traumas actually were never their own traumas. It was actually deeply inappropriate for them to be trying to hold it in themselves, although it is unconscious that that was the case. And actually, as they enter into this larger space, the liminality actually begins to move the trauma into its right location, and something transformational happens. So that's the situational assessment. We're in a situation where there is an arbitrarily large number of specific things that are happening that are appropriate to the perspectives and location of individuals and cultures. What's going on in South Africa is a South African thing. If you're not watching that, pay attention. It's real. Right? South Africa is a place, and the way they're responding is the way that South Africa is responding. We saw Singapore respond the way Singapore responded. China responded the way China responded. Everybody's response is obviously the hard-coded nature of the character of who they are and where they are, and surfaces both the virtue and the vice in its highest bas relief. And the characteristics of the crisis embedded in the phenomenon of the largest systemic dynamics that we're operating in is just creating a huge strobe light effect, so that if you're paying attention, you can see a lot of stuff in yourself and in the people around you and the larger environment. What I expect to see soon, and I in fact am not particularly prescient because it's already happening and I see it already, is people beginning to glom together and beginning to form cultures that respond in different ways than the entrained systems that are jerking them around back and forth. You know, very practically. There are now gatherings of people who are looking at what's going on. Let's just say in the United States, because again, economics and finance tends to be closely tied to some of our most obvious vices. And they're saying, no, we're not going to put up with that. That's not going to happen. The powers that be may think that they're in charge, but they may not be. And we may soon discover what it's like to actually have, 350 million guns and 50 billion bullets. That may happen. We may start seeing communities just sever their ties and say, you know what, we're just going to take care of ourselves. Good luck to you. And by the way, in many cases, that's already happening, but not quite as, grotesquely. Governors, state governors are recognizing that the federalism movement started back in the Great Depression and blew up through the latter half of the 20th century is now somewhat rapidly being forced back down. The governor of New Jersey today is being presented with a model of what New Jersey needs to do as New Jersey, and it is not symmetric with what's being done at the federal level. And if he doesn't do it, then that question will almost certainly be pushed down to mayors and counties and corporations and churches and communities, because people are going to have to start making choices on their own on the basis of their own sense-making and their own capacities, because, well, to be perfectly honest, we cannot yet rely on the forces that we typically have been told to rely on to do the right thing, full stop, and certainly not the right thing for us. And that's okay, because at the end of the day, I think that's what we all, well, I'll just not say we all, certainly that's what I think has been the case for a long time, that this structure, this architecture that was actually very effective at doing certain things in the middle of the 20th century, probably peaked in the late 70s, has been engaging in an increasingly delusional and manic effort to maintain its control and relevance. But it was obsolete a long time ago. And to the best extent possible, if we can use this crisis and this meta crisis to force us to move from complacency and addiction into something like a new form of agency, it would be a very, very good thing. The problem, of course, is if we do that in piecemeal and there's not a way to find some coherence in that movement, and smaller groups begin to pull against each other, that creates an enormously new form of crisis. And so that's what I've got my eyes on right now, to be perfectly frank, is a crisis that emerges when people begin to decohere and begin to start to find new ways of coherence, and whether or not those new ways are able to hold together in anything. They could. There's no reason why they couldn't be amazing, but it's not clear that they will. All right, Direct Me Collective. What should we be focusing on now?
So if you have a question for Jordan, write it down in the chat. And I'll ask him a question right now, and then I'll read out your questions, or I'll call on you to ask it to Jordan. So to circle back to that campfire analogy, John came in yesterday and had a session here, and he talked about how the campfire is sort of like a proto-religious space. And I'm feeling sort of like a churchly vibe in the Stoa in the last like 8 sessions I've done, especially with like when I'm using more of the WeSpace tech. And the frame I'm trying to hold over this whole project is sort of, I think Jim Rutt called it the proto B. It's like this space is designed to fail in the game A sense. And you mentioned all these other people are like doing similar type like things and projects. And so I guess, what is your advice or recommendation to hold the frame and the space in order to be maximally collaborative during this, these times?
Well, I don't know how many people have been watching the conversations that John and I have been having, but one of the things that I think is coming out of that I really appreciate is the rescuing or the recovery, the archaeological resuscitation of concepts and terms. And you just mentioned churchly. So I think it's, let's be clear. The church is not the building. The church is the people. It always has been the people. The people coming together in a particular commitment, in a covenant, right? We have words to describe these things, just need to be able to reconnect with the actual meaning of the terms. A relationship of care, or the sacred, we have that too. A relationship, a right relationship to the sacred, which of course is the moment of meaning, the moment of import, the moment of the source of which guides effective choices. So to enter into a church relationship is the calling, to rediscover that, to rebuild in ourselves the capacity to be in that kind of relationship, which is exactly the kind of architecture that is equal to the moment that we find ourselves in. And I'm not sure that we actually need to use any of the language that sort of Jim and I have sort of hacked with poor tools out of the conceptual environment. It's not name game B, let's just do it and be the people that are acting in that way. We don't need to be telling stories. We need to be enacting them, living them. And now's a very good time for it.
Joe asked this question to John last night, and he wanted to ask it to you again. So Joe, if you can put yourself off mute and ask Jordan.
Sure. Thanks for doing this, Jordan. Like Peter said, I asked this question to Johnny V yesterday on a campfire call. And it was pretty highly resonant with what you were saying at the beginning of the talk. So I'll just ask it. I wrote, in the eyes of regular people, the people who are in the positions of strategic leverage, be that heads of industry, of government, of education, what have you, they seem to be locked into some sort of game A fundamentalism and have been, you know, for many decades, which is essentially the whole blue church idea. Does the game B crowd, being the people who are working on this project, sort of behind the scenes, have a concrete plan for simply nudging these people's direction making or these people's decision making and sort of transforming from nudging to sort of transforming the framework entirely? Because, like, from what you've written, start at the individual, upgrade your sovereignty, upgrade your integrity, and sort of let it scale from there. But, you know, from a plebeian like myself, it's like, well, what more can I do?
So are you asking the question of how can I get President Trump to change his framework? Or are you asking the question of how do I get Joe Rivera to be effective?
I think you've made it pretty clear in your talks and the things you wrote how to make Joe Rivera effective. But I don't know how that scales up.
Aha. All right. In some sense it scales sideways, but let's okay. Pause for a bit. Sure. So there's two big moves that are going on in terms of that question, as far as I can tell. One thing is to recognize that you can never change anybody's mind, and every endeavor you do so actually hardens it. Okay, great. Now what you can do is you can be of service. You can tell the truth and you can interact with humility. I'm here to help. If you are interested, here's my perspective. And by the way, I'm probably as out of touch and blindsided and bullshitting myself as anybody else. And it's just trying to be of service. Now, there's another thing. And this other thing is really, really big. And it has to do with something like, what's the phrase? Where attention goes, energy flows. One of the phrases that came into my head last night was the calculus of cowardice. And I think this is a big illness that we suffer from. Eric Weinstein is, I think, the guy who first brought this into my mind. You know, what's the coward do? How is it that we've actually found ourselves to be led almost exclusively by people who run by the calculus of cowardice? Well, what the coward does is the coward watches. The coward maintains optionality. The coward waits and looks and invites the heroes to step in and put their neck on the line. Now, if the hero's right, the coward steps in front of it, presents the coward itself as being the hero, and tries to steal the virtue that should be flowing to the hero. If the hero is wrong, the coward heaps shame and scorn on the hero for his foolishness and tries to steal the virtue that should have gone to the hero. It is incumbent upon us to simultaneously be heroes, but also to know where the virtue needs to go, and to know that the calculus of cowardice needs to be one of the things that we are aware of in ourselves. To what degree are we allowing ourselves to fall into that trap? And to what degree are we allowing ourselves to be fooled by that trap? Because if we can get away from it, we can simply allow those who are making choices on the basis of their best sense making and putting themselves at risk to be the recipients of virtue, to be recipients of healthy, good attention, then we begin to systematically downregulate what is essentially venality and bad behavior. Again, a very simple choice. The governor of New Jersey right now has a choice. He has an opportunity. He can listen to good sense making and make choices that are in the best interest of his people, or he can choose the coward's calculus. If he chooses A, great. That's a good news. That means that New Jersey will be better off as a state than the states around it. If he chooses path B, then everybody else needs to be aware of that, and they need to be very careful to make sure that they're not flooded into believing alternative than what their eyes are actually telling them. We kind of know what's going on, but we're very easy to confuse and to deceive. And of course, confusion and deception has been weaponized to a very high level. So that's one piece. And the reason I bring that up is this thing I wrote on my Facebook page about the difference between peacetime and wartime. One of the things that we know happens is that during wartime, which is to say during times of crisis where choices have real consequences and where the implications of those choices can be felt quickly and in a very visceral, salient fashion, there's an opportunity to select against cowards and to reselect for heroes. And heroes in leadership can be at any level in any way, and they're happening all over the place. You know, right down into those emergency rooms where nurses are manufacturing hazmat suits out of trash bags and going right back into the front lines. So that's one piece, right? Collectively, if we simply begin to make that choice and begin to orient in that way and select against cowardice and select for heroism, then individuals who are sitting right next to the levers of power can begin to find ways in themselves to either step into that, right? The person who can make good choices for the common weal can find themselves empowered to do so. And also, of course, the individuals who won't may find themselves shamed or best rode out on a rail. Now, how do then we, the people, step into it? Whoops, I'm going to close the chat window because I realize it's going to distract me. Well, that's this. And I don't mean that in the least bit superficially. How many people are in this call right now? About 30 or 40, maybe 50? 37. Look, I have digital technology telling me exactly the number. I don't have a count manual. How many of these could you do as an individual in a day? How many of those need to be done stochastically across the entire human population to have effectively everybody N plus two from everybody else? Actually, not that many. And if you can actually get really, really good at it and start figuring out how to flow that, in a period of 2 or 3 weeks, we will have in fact developed the capacity to begin to move back into the meshwork of human interrelationships in these campfire constructs. And we'll begin to self-organize into tribes. It can't help but be otherwise. That's what we are. Right? We find ways of finding those people who are most valent and resonant with both our values and our sensibilities. But we can also do that in a way that has a meshwork connection. So we're not tribes standing next to each other with inside and outside, but we're actually finding nodes that are part of a larger holistic wholeness. The evolution of our collective individuality into these fractal layers of connectivity is the movement that has been named Game B. Discovering how to do that in embodied practice by just doing it and doing it and doing it with velocity and commitment and openness and learning rapidly is the answer to the question. There is no better solution to it. I don't know how to do that with a formal model. I can give you hints and some heuristics. I mean, I can give you theory all day long, but it's not going to help you. I've already given it. Right now, it's in the hands of everybody to start figuring it out and to share that collective wisdom and to get better as practitioners. I mean, imagine if I told you a story about what a jazz band looked like. Until you start fucking playing music, you're not going to really get it. But once you get it and start feeling what the groove feels like, it suddenly becomes quite obvious. And that's where we are.
All right. So we have a lot of questions coming in. I think it would be good to start with Amy's because it's pretty practical on the ground level. So Amy, if you could unmute yourself.
Hello. Hi, Jordan.
Hi.
I had one, super straightforward, practical. What region, country, city do you think has shown the best response thus far and why?
Yeah, that's actually a super, super interesting question because it's actually hard to know what best means. Because it's actually hard to know exactly what it is we're trying to do. Now, in terms of inhibiting the rollout of the virus with the minimum impact on the normalcy of life, Singapore is the easy answer. Israel, by the way, is also more or less in exactly that same bucket. In terms of the context of their local environment, in some sense, they showed that their culture has high quality sense making and high quality choice making in response to something of this kind. Best I can say. And by the way, both of those are clearly better than their neighbors. And Korea did pretty good. Singapore did really good. But this question of good is an interesting question. And to what degree is Israel actually maximally healing from the things that Israel needs to heal from? Different question. I can say right now that it really, really looks like Sweden is going to get a real good dose of medicine. And they're making choices going polar opposite of what you might call best practices from a intellectual epidemiological level. And that will excise a lot of demons. I think Nora talked about it as you've got your, I'll use my own case. You've got your somewhat naive and yet inevitably rebellious 20-year-old daughter who's about to get her heart broken. Not a whole lot you can do about it. It's part of life. So it's a powerful question. I mean, I think it's a very powerful question. I don't know that there's an easy answer. If I try to provide a prescription from a point of view, I don't really know the interior of Italy. And I can say that there's a sort of obvious case study that Iran and Italy should have as a clusterfuck in terms of handling the virus, but maybe a clusterfuck's exactly what they needed. I don't mean that in like some kind of airy-fairy next new age notion that everything's perfect, and not in the slightest. I'm just saying that there's always an opportunity to learn from what in fact actually happened. Like the key thing that this thing is doing is giving us a fantastic opportunity to look at the mirror and having a very hard time bullshitting ourselves. So I would say that the answer to your question will only be found in retrospect. Those people who most effectively cut through the bullshit and learned the most fully about who they are and learned about their strengths and weaknesses and upgraded their capacity to actually respond to the reality of the environment they're living in, that's who. Maybe it's us.
Okay. Ernesto, would you like to unmute yourself and read your question?
My question was related to the fact that if you are predicting or expecting movement from cities to less, more rural areas, and if you expect that maybe individual groups will be repossessing like 20 million homes that are now empty in the USA.
The question is whether I predict that. Uh-huh. Ha, yes. How funny is that? So I cannot give you a rational explanation for why that's the case. And by the way, no particular timeline. So it may not happen in the next weeks or months, but the part of me that I rely on most to make good guesses about what's going to happen in the future says, yes, I do expect that to be the case in the evolution of this thing over, say, the next couple of years, maybe five on the outside.
Okay. Tyson Wagner. You had a question about QAnon?
Yes, thank you. QAnon has this, in my personal experience and what I see in my community, this kind of captivating, almost seductive, sensational thing going on in the way it captures people's attention. And I'm wondering, like, what can we learn about good distributed collective intelligence from QAnon? And then what should we be most cautious of when looking at that and learning from that?
That's a really good question. Thank you. It's also, by the way, a bold question because, as you know, even I think using the letter Q these days tends to get you thrown in jail. So let's see. Let's think about that. So first off, let's recognize that I think that the answer to the first part is a lot. I think it's naive beyond comprehension to not recognize that that was a very powerful, valuable experience from which we can learn a lot. So what are some of the things that showed up? If you think about it, and I was watching it very closely for a long time. So some of the things that showed up, I would say, are like cardinal virtues, you know, deep stuff that frankly has been part of any culture that's worth a shit for a long time. And phrases like where we go one, we go all. Notions like own your mistakes. Notions like take responsibility for actually digging. You know, take personal responsibility for perceiving reality. Think bigger. Don't be trapped in existing ideological frameworks of what is and what is not. Be aware of the fact that disinformation is everywhere. So don't stick to any particular point of view and assume that that is authoritative. Hope, community, connecting with each other, helping each other. Now this, like, you know, in some sense, it isn't that complicated. Just take a look at the mythopoetic archetypes of what virtue and heroism and wholesomeness have always looked like, and do that. And to the degree to which the Q community found that and upregulated that, that is the strong positive virtues that are infecting that community. All right, now let's go to the opposite direction. And it's weird because it seems to hold both simultaneously, which is kind of an interesting thing. Well, there's a certain mania, right? There's a certain manic, psychotic sensibility. We live in a psychotic age. And we live in a psychotic age because we all have the capacity to interact with far more information about reality than A, our minds can handle, and far less information about reality than B, actually tells us much about reality. So in an environment, we can tell really awesome stories. We can weave together narratives that sort of hold the information that we've been able to gather and hold into something like a coherent story. And then we try to fact check that by actually doing more information. This is where I think where the Q phenomenon has is one of its biggest gaps, is that it's so bound to the virtual. And it's so capable of researching things in the virtual, but then tries to draw conjectures on the basis of inference and hypothesis and models of nature and models about what the underlying axiomatic structures of reality are. So if you think that, I don't know, let's go with something. If you think that there's an organization called Rizvi Tiverse, which is tied to the Saudi royal family, and they have certain capacities and agendas, then you can use that assumption complex about which you have no reality to explain a very large number of phenomena. Now, you're going to get a whole bunch of anomalous phenomena around that, but you're going to pretend to ignore the anomalous phenomena and be really happy about the thing that's inside your explanatory framework, which is to say, the Q phenomenon gives us bas relief on the weakness of the paradigmatic mind, full stop. It tended to be psychotic and manic and to be self, what's the term? Biased towards its own self-referentiality. And of course, we've also seen a tendency, a strong tendency, although not necessarily a overwhelming tendency, to engage in the exact opposite of responsibility, to externalize, to hope that someone else is in charge and will in fact take care of us. And I believe that is also, unfortunately, at the end of the day, false. Which is to say only this, to the degree which there are people who are in positions of power, authority, and responsibility who have our best interest in mind, great, awesome. If we take responsibility for ourselves with complete integrity, then their interest and our interest would be completely aligned. So we don't need to worry about whether they're there or not. But to the degree to which we alienate ourselves from our own agency and just sort of step back and really hope they're doing a good job and become cheerleaders or fans in a sporting event, and they're the team on the field and we're the guys with the butts in the seats, we've done exactly the wrong thing. I'm sure there's more, but that's enough for now, I reckon.
Okay. Isaias, you had a question about initiation, video games, and masculinity.
Yeah.
Sorry.
On the previous situational assessment that you did, you mentioned something about how kids playing Minecraft had a lot of untapped potential to deal with like the issues in the meta crisis. And I've recently read a lot of Jungian thinkers, like Robert Bly's Iron John comes to mind, where they diagnose the crisis of masculinity as lacking initiation rituals from boyhood to manhood. So I'm wondering if you have any suggestions on how Gen X or millennial men can sort of rebuild that framework for the younger generation. Well, I guess another way of putting it is, how can we bring teenagers into the campfire?
That's a really, really good question. That's a big deal. And I like the way you actually named it in terms of Gen X, millennials, and teenagers, right? Because there's something about the phases of life that are different. How old are you, Isaias? You're on mute.
31.
31. How many kids you got?
I don't have kids.
So. All right. So you and I are sort of somewhat different positions in terms of this arc of life. And there's a couple of folks here who look like they're, you know, my senior, and a couple of folks maybe your junior. And man, oh man, it sure is the case that we dropped the ball on that, isn't it? Like, to the degree to which we didn't just not initiate people into adulthood, we sort of did exactly the opposite in every possible way. So we've got a lot of catching up to do. And I got to really say, I have a bad feeling, and I apologize for that bad feeling, but I have a bad feeling that my elders, they're the ones who had an opportunity to actually have what's called intergenerational transmission, but for whatever reason chose to step away from that and did not rebuild it in a new way, at least to my awareness. So we're kind of having to go inside. You know, we can't rely on rituals or traditions that have been handed down to us, because whatever rituals or traditions were handed down to us are either handed down and dropped and left behind, or are so out of place that we don't know how to use them well. Then we can recover stuff from older environments. And there's actually some pretty good stuff out there that other cultures still do and use. But we should be careful not to simulate. And I oftentimes refer to the folks who wear way too many feathers. I mean, if you know who I'm talking about, I'm going to call that a certain simulation. But there are lots of good things that exist in lots of cultures around the world that understand how to do this thing well. What I would say is that here's more or less the nature of the beast. Each of us as kind of cohorts, the boomers, the Xers, the millennials, and Gen Z, have sort of like a generational crisis that has to do with something like the thing that we have to get over. To some extent, the boomers have to get over, and I'm just going to call it narcissism. And it has to do with something like, I mean, to be perfectly frank, when they were young, they were golden children, right? And everything, whether they as individuals, I think everybody's an individual, and their life arc as individuals is quite diverse, but as a generation, things kind of worked out. They have an embodied sense of things kind of working out. But now they're into life. And by the way, with this virus, they may be closer to end of life than they maybe thought they were going to be. And it's the ability to turn their attention towards what is in fact the legacy of their generation, to recognize that they probably don't have a lot in the terms of, let's call it, know-how. Which is to say their expertise is expertise associated with an environment that is increasingly in the past. But they have a whole lot in terms of wisdom, you know. So I'm not really that interested in most cases, not in all cases, in your institutional knowledge. I don't really care that much about how the Federal Reserve works, because it's going to go away real quick. I care a whole lot about life. I care a whole lot about meaning. I care a whole lot about how what it was actually like back in the day when communities really existed and people really cared for each other. What is actually valuable? Where should we be orienting our attention? What really matters? Right? Elders, elder. I need the elders to elder. So then you got my cohort. These poor fucking slackers of Gen X. Right, we got to get over ourselves and stop being nihilists. Right? We just have to actually step in and say, okay, some of us have actually built a capacity to have some level of effectiveness in the moment. And most of us have skin in the game. And we actually have kids that we care about. So we have an embodied relationship with our own bodies, have competence and expertise. But our biological bodies put us very much in the, this thing needs to happen. But in many ways, we also don't really know what to do. We're behind the curve. So we need to support. We need to put ourselves in a support role to help the millennials do the things that ultimately at the end of the day, the load's going to fall on the millennials to make this thing happen. I think that just needs to be clear. All right, so the millennials. Responsibility. And Dr. Jordan Peterson, I think, showed up as a teleportation from this future. For better or for worse, but he shook a whole lot of people into recognizing that is the millennial crisis. Ball's in your hands, guys. Step up. That's all there is to it. Think about what happened in World War II. Right? In World War II, a whole bunch of 20 and 25-year-old kids got thrown right in the middle of machine gun bullets. They had to carry the responsibility for the war in their bodies. And if they didn't, the whole thing was over. Right? It wasn't there the equivalent of Gen X and the boomers. Franklin Roosevelt was doing fireside chats. And Patton was sitting back behind the back lines trying to help people make good choices. It was the kids on the front lines who were actually tearing most of the load. That's kind of where we are now. But of course, our front lines are spiritual front lines and community front lines and relearning how to do those things from scratch. Now, in some sense, you have the enormous advantage that our educational system is a complete shit show, which is to say they didn't train you very well, which means you can just kind of throw it out the back door and relearn really quickly. On the other hand, the reality is that the millennials have an incredible level of capacity, like extraordinary level of capacity, both in terms of just sheer smarts and also in terms of like heart. Like the ball we dropped in sort of training masculinity actually built up capacities in young men that we would not have otherwise had. you know, my generation doesn't have a lot of the capacities that your generation has that are going to be needful right now. And things like empathy and self-awareness and EQ. Just talk to a like a real actual boomer man and get a sense of how fragile the EQ was of that particular generation. So take those capacities and then reboot that with a new sensibility of what a new masculinity looks like, and recognize that. Just imagine that you are going to be responsible for a family. What does that feel like? What does it mean to prepare a territory where you actually take responsibility for the area around you? What does it mean to actually identify in your body the feeling of other men who can actually stand arm in arm and shoulder and turn themselves towards the threat and stand and have it break against them, right? If you can feel that energy, that's the energy to get into. Now we've got the other side. We've been talking a lot about men, but this is, of course, fundamentally a female crisis. Let's be very clear. The feminine energy is that which is being called up in the hardest level across all generations. I don't even know what that looks like. I just know it's the case. I can feel it. Every time I feel it in my wife, for example, as she digs deeper and deeper and deeper into learning how to discover in herself the anchor, the grounding. You know, there's actually a really good story. It's the very first chapter of The Grapes of Wrath. Anybody read that? It's like it's exactly the situation, right? So it looks like this. It's like maybe even like the first three paragraphs. He, Steinbeck, talks about the it's the Okies, the sharecroppers, and the men, they go out and they put their hands in the dirt and they sift it and they look at the sky and they look at the crops and they chat with each other and try to kind of figure out what's going on. And the women, they're inside in the house, right? They're holding the family and they're holding the hearth and holding the grounding and they're looking and watching. But then something happens. Where suddenly you just get this moment where suddenly the woman goes, "We're leaving." She makes the call. This watering hole is no longer valid. Your responsibility is now shifted from trying to make those crops work to getting this family to somewhere safe, right? And of course, as soon as she says it, you can see the man just drops what he's doing and pivots. I don't know if you've been married, but by the way, that's how it works. So that's kind of it. And by the way, just learning how to do that at the simple level is a really good practice. And a lot of people are having to be forced to learn that right now because we're no longer able to really, really distract ourselves with work and school and hopefully media, and having to relearn how to just be in relationship with the people we happen to be stuck in quarantine with. But that simple stuff of right relationship between the masculine and the feminine, the right relationship between men and women, which aren't necessarily exactly the same thing, is a big part of the nature of this crisis. And to the degree to which we learn that and relearn that and rebuild capacities by interacting with other people and learning what works and what doesn't work and deal with our own fear and limitations in ourselves and grow through it as rapidly as possible, this also begins to talk about what Joe was talking about. I think I've rambled on at length on that. I apologize.
David, you asked a couple of questions. The recent one about the self-deception and shadows.
Yeah. So Jordan, as we move from theory to practice, as we get on the actual field, we find out real quick which of our notions are shadow projections and which ones will grow corn. How do you personally address and embrace the courage to face your self-deception honestly?
Well, it's kind of an interesting question, isn't it? Because you can't really bootstrap yourself into that, because the guy who's bootstrapping is the guy you got to worry about. So let me tell you what I noticed. I'll just be very upfront. We have my particular family situation has a very odd circumstance, which is that my wife's pregnant. And we got some interesting data back on that particular pregnancy. And the data makes things, let's say, challenging to deal with. And so as I was doing, like taking my time out from dealing with all the other crises that go on the outside and focus some time on what's going on the inside, I noticed the desire to bullshit myself. I noticed the desire as I'm looking and reading scientific papers to upregulate the ones that made me feel better and downregulate the ones that made me feel worse. That's a pretty simple thing. If you've built the capacity to just be metacognitive, to be aware of that tendency and to say, okay, well, I actually can tell. I can kind of notice in myself where my bullshit strategies. I mean, our bullshitter is strong, but he's not that sophisticated. If you can kind of get outside of it and allow yourself to just be aware of the fact that bullshitter is going to be working overtime all the time and just kind of have a mindfulness of, oh, yeah, there it is. It's showing up there. I think that's pretty helpful. You know what I'm saying? And I don't think there's a categorical answer, because the second you think you got a handle on something, that's exactly the place where you create a blind spot. So it's a little bit like just recognizing you just have to be in it and try to be listening and have, I think, a lot of self-forgiveness and humility. Like, humility is a key. Like, humility really helps in the bullshit front. If you don't allow yourself to become self-righteous, then allow yourself to become right. You actually just really allow yourself to kind of be in the middle of it and looking and trying to do your best. That creates a smoother surface. It's harder for the bullshit to stick. For myself, by the way, I also resort back to a lot of the tools and techniques that I've been working on for the past 5 or 6 years. I mean, a lot of these Stoic practices or Buddhist practices or Taoist practices, just take a time out, ground yourself, and go out into nature. I go at least 2 hours a day. I try to be as barefoot, and these days, since I'm out in the Texas Hill Country naked in the fields of flowers, and just kind of allow nature to flow and tune in out everything and just listen to what's going on. And that creates space, right? It creates gaps. It doesn't let the ego mind and the limbic system to kind of narrow your visibility. When fear is the mind killer, this is sort of like grounding is the mind releaser. Stuff like that. I think those are good things. And frankly, this is very powerful. And I find that I spend too much of my time focused on trying to address things that you might consider to be tactical. And I can notice upon reflection that I actually get very locked into a sort of an optimizing framework for moving sense-making into action. You know how that feels? Because you have to use a lot of sense-making, and you want to move from a liminal space to an effective space. All right, so how do you actually move back and forth? Closing and opening, and kind of breathing in and breathing out, and using nature and using people and using bodies to be able to support you in that movement. And then I guess there's the last one, which is hopefully by this point, you know what your addictions are. Don't do that. Be very careful.
Yeah. It's, to circle back to Jordan Peterson, and he was my therapist for 2 years before he became famous. And we talked a lot about millennials and masculinity. And during that time I developed this kind of aggressive debate modality that kept our bullshit in check, which, you know, Peterson helped boost that signal. So I might return that to the Stoa. It could be helpful during these times. Noam, you had a question?
Sure. This is actually potentially more tactical, so I hope you do answer it in a less tactical way. I think that may be appropriate. So my sense is that if you have this mesh type of structure building, not everything, obviously, when you have individual responsibility and bottom-up responsibility, nobody can control anybody at a certain distance, and people may be inclined towards many, many different interpretations and many different ways of dealing with what's in front of them. And some of those may feel to them right and good, and it may not be, and it may in fact get pathological, and they may be taking shortcuts, and the incentives may be there to do things in ways that, if they become a force that's destructive. So how do you communicate across different domains so that we can, that's people that can influence things in a way that creates more space, creates more pause, and ultimately more of a game B, I guess, answer. More of a game B outcome.
Well, it's funny because you said tactical, but I cannot help but actually just go up to sort of more in the direction of principles.
Right.
Here's my sense of it. It's funny because I'm about to reveal one of my own personal addictions, but I found myself watching episode 2 of The Mandalorian yesterday. I swore to God I wouldn't be on Disney TV, but we hacked a free version, so I feel okay about it. There's that cool little funny-looking character who has that phrase, "I have spoken." And as you were talking, I just kind of had that guy pop up. There's something about integrity that I think is the answer to the question. Again, you can't make anybody change their mind. You certainly can't make anybody change their behavior. You can choose exactly how you're going to show up. And you can choose who you're going to be in relationship with and where you're going to give your attention. And kind of like that's it. But I think it's a deep insight that is often lost, and that's that human beings are obligate tribal. As individuals, we are always, always seeking to find our tribe, trying to find the kin that connect with us, with whom we resonate, and our place in there. To have no place, actually, it's funny. I actually remember having a conversation with an individual who's one of the last standing indigenous groups in North America. And to have no place is one of the deepest crises. So in some sense, feel in yourself the degree to which the individuals you're interacting with, is this actually your kin group? Is this right relationship? And I don't mean necessarily your genetic kin group. I just mean people for whom the relationship is the right one. And if not, integrity. Do not bullshit yourself. Do not become divided against yourself. Just tell the truth. And I don't mean being mean. I just mean being honest with as much love and peacefulness as you can muster to communicate the truth clearly, so at least other people's hearts hear it, even if their minds and egos don't. And that supports, right? Because that also then becomes not just a relationship, it becomes an educational or a learning, a paideic relationship. Because in doing that yourself and learning it in yourself, you're creating something that becomes a mechanism or a symbol or an archetype or an avatar of emulation. Right? People are looking for things that show them how they themselves can grow. Try to be in yourself that thing which you hope to be. And then in so doing, you will show to others that to the degree to which you are successful. They will show it to you, and then you can learn from each other. It's something like that. Right? So it's, again, very simple stuff. And listen to your instincts. You know, this is, we're now in the situation where thinking, getting in your head, gets in the way. It's okay to use rationality in the Vervaekian sense. And that's a different kind of animal than trying to use analytics or cognitive structures. You know, hopefully by now you've built some skillfulness. And if you haven't, practice that. And being able to have good instincts, make good effective choices, and just notice how to move through mistakes and learn from mistakes quickly. Like, this is that Kairos moment. It's the moment of flow. It's the moment where every choice has massive implications. It's not a Kronos moment. So it's time to be in it, to unveil your warrior self and dive into the fray. And you have to dance and move and flow with what is happening and what is real, and just be in it and grow with it as quickly as you can.
Awesome. And with one more question, two people had a question, Nick and Joel, about the U.S. decision to go put troops on the Canadian border. Nick, would you like to read that out? Nick Kennedy?
Unmute. Sorry, guys. 1 second here. Hey, Jordan. So, yeah, about 25 minutes ago, the White House said they are planning to put troops on the U.S.-Canadian border. This seems like a really novel piece of geopolitical information. I was wondering if you had any immediate read time.
Well, unfortunately, I've got now 7 more or less equally weighted meta theories about the nature of what's going on geopolitically. And by equally weighted, what I mean is that I can't actually bias in the direction I did. So what I have to do is take that data, run it in through all three of these, know that they're probably all wrong, but at least I get some degree of perspective on it. And it's not worth our time to go through all of them iteratively. What I would say is, how do I say this? More or less everybody is aware of the phrase, don't let a good crisis go to waste. More or less nobody's in a position to actually make effective choices that are in the best interest of everybody. Which means we got all kinds of little groups pulling in different directions, trying to maneuver things. And a lot of them aren't actually trying to do bad things. They're just doing the best of what they've got. But it creates all kinds of weird complications. Why we would put troops on the Canadian border? Let me actually make that a little bit more clear. Why the fuck would we put troops on the Canadian border? That's the appropriate question. I would say that's a good goddamn question. I'd be interested in anybody's perspective on that. Who are these guys? Those troops should be in New York City right now, not in the Canadian border. And I don't mean putting down citizens. I mean moving things back and forth to where they need to be. Yeah, good question. Hijinks are afoot. Shenanigans are going on everywhere. So don't let your conspiratorial tin hat overheat, but keep your eyes open. I mean, there's things going on all over the place. And it's a feeding frenzy out there. And the Russians are moving, the Chinese are moving, all the different sub-tribes in the Western Anglo-American Alliance are moving. Everybody's beginning to realize that either they need to take care of themselves at the expense of everybody else, or they can start grabbing grass from somebody else's field. So that's another crisis that's brewing, by the way. Just to be mindful, the geopolitical crisis is, it's got a lot of tinder, a lot of dry tinder. And I named this, and every situational assessment I've talked about has been front and center, and it's awfully front and center right now. So sadly, I cannot give you any clarity. All I can say is, yep, that's really an anomalous thing.
Okay. So we'll close off soon. I'll make some announcements, but any closing thoughts, Jordan?
Do more of this. and do variations of it. Stoa is a good one. Invite other people into Stoa. I haven't been in one. Jump into something like the crazy hipster Burning Man thing that I just did yesterday with Benita Roy. Tap into what Nora Bates is doing. See if you can yank Brett Weinstein out of his chair and get into engaging his variation on this theme. Right? We probably need about 15 or 16 different epistemological modalities driving this particular construct, and then have them co-evolutionarily exact each other's best stuff and evolve rapidly. But groups like this gathering on a continuing paced basis and beginning to learn very rapidly, this is the answer to the question.
Very cool. So as what Jordan just said, we have some interesting people coming in. Jim Rutt on Monday, Robin Hansen, Yancey Strickler from Kickstarter. This evening, we have an existential dance party at 7 p.m. And I'd love it for you to be there, Jordan, to see your dance moves. I'm sure everyone else would like to see that as well.
My daughter and I have been doing dances every night.
You can bring her along as well. Check out the website, the stoa.ca, for updates. Sign up for the mailing list. And I'm viewing this digital campfire, the Stoa, as a gift for all of us to freely use during this meta crisis. If you're inspired to provide a gift in return, you can go to the gift economy section at the bottom of the website for more information. So thanks again, Jordan, for helping out today, giving us your feedback and sense making, and everyone else for being on the call.
Very good. Thanks, guys.